Honored to have with us today Joseph Tewodros, who recently held a 25-hour session of praying the Eulog for world peace, for Palestine. I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about your experience playing for 25 hours straight.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. Yeah, I mean, it's not something I'd recommend, to be honest. I went in very naive and thought, yeah, I could do this, it'll be a breeze. But it was hard to keep up, I guess, the energy and the... But the spirit of the people that came really motivated and inspired me to continue. And that's what the beautiful thing of it was. But yeah, it is a very, very long slog to be playing. And I only had one break at the 17th hour. That was for a toilet break. So I pretty much played continuously. I didn't really have any breaks. Improvised for most of it. I didn't have a set list, but the cause was a good one, and you know, it was about raising money for the emergency Christmas appeal for the Amos Trust, and we raised over 18,000 British pounds, which is pretty good, which is about 36,000 Australian dollars. And so, yeah, it was worth you know, putting it on the line for that.
Wow, and I understand that fundraiser is still open. People can still donate to that yes. Christmas appeal.
Yes, we're going to keep it open till the Orthodox Christmas, in which I'm a part of. I'm Coptic Orthodox, born in Egypt, the Egyptian Orthodox. So they celebrate on the 7th of January. So we'll probably keep it to that Christmas. And of course, a lot of people in Palestine as well celebrate on that date.
And can you just share briefly what the Amos Trust is and what the work is that they do?
Well, they help rebuild things in areas, not just Palestine, but this is for particularly the people in Gaza. But yeah, they have projects with rebuilding in war zones and things like that. So really want that money to go far, and especially with what we see and what's happening. I just, you know, we need some sort of support, because I, you know, a lot of the time, a lot of people feel helpless. I felt helpless seeing the images, and this is why I really wanted to make a statement with this concert. It's not just about, you know, just playing a little small part. This was really physically and mentally putting myself on the line, and feeling a little bit of that toughness and hardness as well. It wasn't a rosy, you know, thing to do. And also, I wanted to create that safe space. It wasn't just about having a concert for me, because, you know, obviously, concerts that I usually do are about an hour or 2 hours, and they have a set program, and there's a narrative and a story, and there's the set pieces that you play. Whereas this one was really just a backdrop for people just to take some time out and think about what's happening over there and think of what people are going through. I had the safety of a church, which I knew would exist the day after. And that's not something the luxury, that's not a luxury the people of Gaza have at the moment. They don't know. They could be in a mosque, in a church, in an apartment block, in a garden, anywhere. Nothing is safe for them. And to live in that sort of anxiety and that fear amongst all that pain and chaos, it doesn't really compare to what I was doing. By comparison, what that 25-hour concert, was a walk in the park.
Yeah, and I wonder, we had an event in Portland where we listened to part of the concert, and at the time we were listening, it was early morning. It was between 2 and 5 a.m. there in London where you were playing, and I found myself being drawn into the oud music to what was happening in Gaza at that very moment. And I wonder if that was something that was happening for you or other people who were listening to the music, that it felt like we were connected in a way to the people of Gaza, and wondering, are the bombs dropping right now? What's happening in Gaza at this very moment during those 25 hours?
I think that was the goal of the concert, to unite people. There's a lot of noise that's happening, from all sorts of things, media and just in life, and especially with this stuff that's happening. And there's a bombardment of information, there's a bombardment of propaganda, there's a bombardment of all sorts of things. And this does affect a human being on a daily basis. So I think, this idea and calling it the 24-hour prayer for humanity, it's really a musical prayer, you know what I mean? The music was a backdrop to people's well wishes and good energy to send over there to people that are not doing so well and having a really, really tough time. So I did really feel that connectedness and unity as well. And I was very surprised with the outpouring of compassion and kindness. And I think it was a really beautiful thing to witness and to be a part of. And so, yeah, definitely. And also some moments where I was really struggling in terms of, because it is a long time. It does take its toll. And as I said, I didn't have a break until the 17th hour. There was times where I was like, well, come on, Joe, pull up your socks. There's people doing it tough over there, and you got to do it for them. So you got to use that as an inspiration, and just think of some of the things that really affect you with the images that come out of there, and put that into the playing. And actually, there was a moment, which I did end up posting separately after the event, where I found myself playing Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, the lullaby, and thinking of the children there and how innocent they could be. And I juxtaposed that with a very dark, very chaotic type of playing and melody over that. So, which kind of showed that, innocence within chaos. And that's what I was visualizing, that you have these innocent children that can't be children and are forced to be adults very quickly in life due to the circumstances that they're in.
Yeah, and I also remember a moment towards the end where you were playing "O Come All Ye Faithful," and it was almost had a Christmas feel.
You must have tuned into that. That one was a bit more light-hearted for the people that were there. There was a few die-hard fans that were about 6 in the early hours, of course, which is a hard time slot. So they set up in front of me and were sleeping, and so I decided to do some Christmas carols as well, because we are in the Christmas period and there is about that Christmas cheer. But obviously it's very hard for people over there to be any taking part in any celebrations. But yeah, it's just a very difficult moment. And if we can bring some cheer, some hope, some light within the darkness, then I think that's a very nice role to play.
And I wonder if you could just comment on that Christmas is canceled in Bethlehem this year, that Palestinian Christians are just as much under the bombs as Palestinian Muslims are. As a Christian yourself, an Egyptian, maybe you could just talk about how Christians in Palestine are being impacted, and what the importance is for Christians here in the US.
Well, I mean, a big part of the problem. Look, I we have these thing of religion, and that area is a very significant part for all religions. I mean, the three main religions. As for me, as a Coptic Christian, I mean, Christmas is very important for us, and of course, the Orthodox and what happens there. There's the Orthodox in Palestine as well. They celebrate on a different calendar, which is on the January the 7th. But I just think it's just a humanitarian thing at the end of the day. I think maybe if people realize that there are Christians there, unfortunately, that I have to say that you know, people that are more from, you know, maybe America or different places which are more, I don't want to say, but you know, maybe not Eastern, tend to forget that that's where the story happened. You know, that's where Bethlehem is. People are forgetting that, you know, Jesus, you know, was probably the same color as me, rather than the, you know, the Swedish Jesus, you know, with the blue eyes and the blonde hair that we got used to later on. And I think that narrative is often forgotten. The Middle East has some of the oldest Christian sites in the world, you know, and as we saw, one of the oldest Christian churches in Bethlehem was bombed. Like, what are we doing? This is, we're losing history. We're allowing history to be eliminated. And that's a very sad thing. But I think people need to know that there are Christians, there are Muslims, there are Jews, there are all sorts of you know, people. They just need to be taken care of in a humanitarian aspect. It's not about religion at the end of the day, but there are historical sites, there are histories, and there are very strong Christian histories, and we have to protect them and be with them. But as I said, I don't think religion should be looked in this whole thing. It is really a humanitarian issue.
Yeah, and just to get back to your role and your decision to play the oud for 24 hours, I wonder if you could just talk about the oud itself. Maybe people in our audience aren't familiar with the instrument, and it's a stringed instrument. That's got to be really hard on your fingers, first off, to play for so long.
Well, the oud is the ancestor of the lute, so if people know what the lute is, but in its roundabout form, there was an ancient Egyptian prototype called Nefer. So if we look at the ancient Egyptian temples, or if you look at a cartouche, you see a letter there sometimes, like in the word Nefertiti, a letter called Nefer, which was also an instrument, and that was a type of lute which was taken by the Persians and developed into an instrument called the barbat, and then was developed further by the Arabs, and then taken to Spain by a player called Zeriab in the 9th century, which then became the lute, and the word lute comes from oud, so al oud, lute, and then that becomes the guitar. So it's a very historically significant instrument. It's a fretless instrument. It's not like like a guitar, which having those metal bits, so it's a little bit softer on the fingers, but it's a very beautiful, warm sound, and one that's magical, and one that transports you to the Middle East, and one is that's a good backdrop for prayer. And in the Renaissance times, they used it as a type of healing. They were into that music healing, and that was the oud was a type of you know, resting of the soul. So yeah, it's a beautiful instrument that I've been brought up with. As you can hear from my accent, I'm Australian, but I was born in Egypt. But I was always attached to my Middle Eastern heritage, and the oud allowed me to learn more about my Middle Eastern heritage and carry the tradition forward. And now I find myself in London doing the same thing. So the instrument I love playing, but 24 hours. I mean, I've played long concerts before of 4 hours, and I've played long stretches, but this was literally 25 hours without a break, with that one little break of 3 minutes, and that was it. So I'd somehow found energy by new audiences coming in, because I obviously knew they wouldn't be there all the time. So that was the thing. I would see people coming in and out, and for me, that kept me going and playing, and I didn't want to disappoint them. And also, I said I was going to do something, and I really wanted to do it, and I didn't want to fail at it. And I really think it was a miracle evening, and I'm glad that we could make a difference, albeit in a very small way.
Yeah, it was incredible. I understand that you may have inadvertently gotten a Guinness Book of World Records
Yeah,
record for
in a
the
way.
playing.
We'll have to verify that, but I think, yeah, we're pretty much on our way to getting in the Guinness Book of Records. And I think that's also a really nice thing, because it will say something like, you know, happened at an event for Gaza. So, you know, we'll get the word Gaza in the Guinness Book of Records. And I think that's something very important to have awareness. It's a type of awareness. It's not just about breaking a record. It's also having awareness for the cause of why we did it. And it was just a little bonus, extra bonus that we didn't realize.
It will be not the only time that Gaza's in the Book of World Records, because they also have the largest number of kites flown at one time.
Oh, there we go.
Was in Gaza.
There we go. We've got a double. Well, I'm not in it yet, so they might still be the only ones.
And I just wanted to ask you how you said that getting to play the oud got you connected to your Arabic heritage, but I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about your experience with the oud. When did you start playing, and how did you learn?
I started playing around 10. I saw it in a movie. My family immigrated from Egypt, and they were all movie buffs. They liked watching Egyptian movies and listening to traditional music. And I always wanted to play an instrument. My uncle was a famous trumpet player in Egypt, and I always wanted to play the trumpet, but my parents were like, no, trumpet's a bit too hard. And then I saw the oud in a movie. I'd been familiar with the sound of it, obviously, through the recordings of the traditional songs. And so I was really drawn to it. This particular movie, Seyyed Darwish, who was about a famous Egyptian composer who was a patriot, actually, and was fighting against the English at the time, and was a part of the 1919 Egyptian Revolution. So there was all these little... Yeah, it was just a very great movie, and it really inspired me as a little kid. And I asked my parents if I could play the oud, and I started my journey with it. And with each song, I just felt closer to my Egyptianness, and it helped me, you know, speak better Arabic and learn songs and learn poetry. And music opens up so much, and we have a wealth. The Middle East has a wealth of history in movies, especially Egypt. In movies and songs, and Cairo was a hub. It was like the Hollywood. So even musicians came from all over the Middle East to try and find fame and fortune in Cairo. So that's what I was held on to, and that's what I'm a big fan of, all that traditional music. And I'm now, you know, I was able to combine it with my Australianness and forward it there, and it's forged a career in Australia, which is great. On the oud, now I'm in London doing the same thing over here. So, yeah, I'm pretty happy where the oud's taken me, and wherever we can lend a helping hand and wherever we can help and use our skills to bring awareness to something, or to try and raise money, or to, to give moral support, then I think we should be able to do that.
Yeah, I mean, what an incredible feat to play for 25 hours.
It's still hitting me. I'm still recovering, by the way. I'm so sore. Like, some days I wake up and I'm like, you know, certain pains are in somewhere else. So I still haven't fully recovered from it. I think even if you just stayed awake, not doing anything for 25 hours, if you sat in a chair for 25 hours, that would take its toll on its body. And also, I didn't want to eat anything to upset my stomach. So it was just basically, you know, caffeine and some jelly beans that got me through the day.
Wow. And do you know if word has gotten through to anyone in Gaza that you were doing this? Have you heard anything from anyone in Gaza?
I don't know, but I have other friends that have been monitoring that, and they let me know, but I'm just not sure. I can't really confirm. I can't really say anything, but I hope they felt some sort of, you know, solidarity, and know that people are thinking of them and that they haven't been forgotten.
Yeah, wow. I understand also last year you participated in an oud performance for the memorial service for Shireen Abu Akleh in London. And I wonder if you could talk about that. I mean, we have been hearing about journalists being killed over the last 2 months in Gaza. It's, I think, up to 100 journalists have been killed. Shireen was killed last year in the West Bank, and you performed at that memorial service that was held for her in London.
Yeah, I was invited to play along to that. I mean, I have certain pieces which, you know, commemorate loss and things like that. So I played one piece called Heal. You know, and my thing you know, my music has a lot of hope. It talks about a lot of loss. And, you know, I've lost my parents early on, you know, 10, 15, 10 and 12 years ago. So I've always felt that loss and the importance of healing and the importance of togetherness and, you know, and how we should be there for one another. And I think that's what I like to put in the music. And so I was really happy to play at that memorial. And of course, to remember such a great, an amazing journalist that was, you know, snatched really, and shouldn't have been at all. And this is the type of, you know, pains that we go through, and it's just unfair. And yeah, whenever we get called up, as I said, to do something, then I like to take part, and remember the people that are special and have lost, and we've lost them.
Yeah, well, it was so amazing to listen to you playing, to watch the live stream. Did you get any feedback from the live stream while you were playing, or did you look at it afterwards?
Yes, that was important actually. There were parts where, of course, you know, the audience were asleep. Some people were asleep, and it was a very early time in the night where I could have easily nodded off. But I had the live stream, and I could read the comments. And some people were like, "We're with you, keep going. We're proud of you," and things like that. And it's comments like that that keep you going and lift the morale. And it's really, really important to have that support base. So I'm glad I did put the live stream on, and I could read the comments because they really did keep me going in the end, and just put things in perspective, and you know, push the intention behind it as well. And I think, yeah, I'm so glad that I had that on.
Well, I just thank you so much for joining us and for doing
Thank
what
you.
you did with the 25-hour prayer for humanity. And I wonder if you have any parting words for our audience here in the US.
And I just think that we can't give up, and with that we can't underestimate the power of prayer and the power of togetherness and the power of you know, intention and thought together. And I think around the world there is some sort of connection. We can feel it when we all get together, and think and reflect and love and give our kindness and compassion and just do it all together. There is a power in that, and there is a strength in numbers and a power in prayer. I think that's what I'll leave them with.
Well, thank you so much. Again, we've been speaking with Joseph Tewodros in London, who recently performed a 25-hour oud solo prayer for humanity, raising money for the people of Gaza. Thank you, Joseph, for joining
Yeah,
us today.
thank you. Thank you for having me.
This is Jenkins Davis with TD Radio. You've been listening to an interview with Joseph Tewodros, who is currently based in London. You can listen to his entire 24-hour Oud Marathon for Gaza on facebook.com/JosephTewodrosOud. You can also find his website, josephtewodros.com. That's Joseph, TAWADROS.com. Friday, December 29th from 8 to 10 p.m. to hear part of the 25-hour-long Oud concert held by Joseph Tewodros last week to support the people of Gaza. That will be here on KBOO Radio 90.7 FM, also on KBOO.FM. Next, we go to a local vigil held here in Portland at the University of Portland recently, calling for a ceasefire in Gaza and the end to U.S. complicity in war crimes currently being carried out by Israeli forces.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says, the parties to the conflict, and indeed the international community, us, face an immediate and fundamental responsibility to stop the inhumane collective suffering and dramatically expand humanitarian aid to Gaza. The way forward is clear. A humanitarian ceasefire now. Ceasefire now. In addition to lives lost, there's many other forms of humanitarian and environmental impacts of this war in Gaza. There's been targeting civilians, a blockade of food and medicine and essential services like gas, water, and electricity, and technology in the occupied territories. To that we say ceasefire now.
Ceasefire now.
As part of Israeli blockade of Gaza, all water was shut off in the entire territory. To that we say ceasefire now.
Ceasefire now.
There has been forced transfer and displacement of over 1.5 million people in the small territory of Gaza. To that we say ceasefire now.
Now.
There has been the use of white phosphorus ammunition causing long-term health impacts. To that we say ceasefire now.
Ceasefire now.
There have been indiscriminate attacks on refugee camps, schools, and hospitals, including the Al-Shati camp, the Jabalaya camp, and the UNRWA school airstrike that took place. To that we say ceasefire now.
Ceasefire now.
There's also been attacks on the Al-Dara Children's Hospital, and most recently the Al-Shifa Hospital. These acts have been called official war crimes by the United Nations, and to that we say ceasefire now.
Ceasefire now.
On the 17th October, just 10 days after the start of the war, 880 scholars of international law and genocide signed a public statement saying, as scholars and practitioners of international law, conflict studies, and genocide studies, we are compelled to sound the alarm about the crime of genocide being perpetrated against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. And to that we say, ceasefire now. I want to pass the mic over to Mohammed, a community member who's here to share from PSU Super. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks everyone for being here. My name is Mohammed. I'm from Gaza. My father family came from the city of Yaffa, and my mom's family came from the city of Ramla. Both of their families have been expelled from their places in 1948 and have sought refuge in Gaza City, specifically in Khan Yunis. I grew up most of my life in Gaza, in Khan Yunis, went to the UNRWA schools, and basically for the two-thirds and more of my lives, I lived there. I was there in 2008 when one of the biggest assaults on Gaza at that time have taken place, and I still remember the sound of the bombs till this day, and I was at that time in the middle school, going home from school. Being in this time, in this place, in this cold place, and basically witnessing and reliving the trauma and the war, I can't even imagine what my family in Gaza are going through. I can't even imagine what my friends are going through. Just a little bit about what's going on there. Is, as mentioned before, and before talking about anything that's happening in Gaza, we need to acknowledge something here. We live in the US, and we need to acknowledge that this is a Stalin land, and we need to acknowledge that we are standing here on a Stalin land. So I want to acknowledge the Chinook people, the Multnomah, the Clackamas, and all the native nations and native people who walked on this land before us. So people in Gaza are suffering, and really the American people and the people in the West are the only ones who can stop it. Unfortunately, the leadership is not doing anything, but I know people like you and I can do something. The medical sector entirely is broken down in Gaza. Taking the biggest hospital in the Gaza Strip hostage is an act of murder on the entire population in Gaza. And just think about it. The Shifa Hospital that's under siege right now and being taken by the Israeli army has the only working MRI in the entire Gaza Strip. Imagine 2.3 million people with one MRI, and that MRI is not working anymore. And there's no fuel, there is no water. People, I'm talking to my family, and what I'm hearing is since basically the second week of the war, when my family have run out of fuel, the only way to go and get fuel is to go to the destroyed homes and collect the destroyed furniture and use it as a fuel for fire to cook and feed each other. That's the reality. Thousands and thousands are in schools and in tents. Basically, their only crime is to live in Gaza and to live under the Israeli occupation. Right now, the weather is getting closer to be rainy and cold in Gaza. A few days ago, it rained. Just God knows how much suffering that can bring. If you're sleeping in a tent and it just like rained on you and you have to basically wake up and move the entire family and the entire tent just to be dry. That's the life that's happening there. In addition to the ongoing bombardment, imagine children living for 4+ weeks under constant bombardment. What type of future this child can look for if this is the life that they're living? I have 3 nieces and nephews. One of them is 5 years old, have been already hearing bombs constantly for 2 times in their lifetime. One in 2020 during the Great March of Return, and one in 2023 right now. That's a 5-year-old child. So many people in Gaza have grown up with such reality. So I encourage you to read, because reading is an important thing to do. Because I wish I have time to talk, but it's really cold. And I want to acknowledge that for everyone. But also I want to acknowledge that people in Gaza are suffering more than us can ever imagine. But I encourage everyone to read. And I encourage everyone to read and participate in the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement. The boycotts and divestment and sanction movement is a Palestinian-led movement that started in 2005 and calls for the boycott of Israel, the divestment of every company that invest in aiding the occupation, and sanctioning Israel until it achieves 3 main objectives. One of them is equal rights for every Palestinian who's living in Israel right now. 2 is to remove every aspect of the occupation in the West Bank, including checkpoints, settlements, the apartheid wall, the constant checkpoints that are going and preventing people from reaching their homes and their families from point A to point B. Some students are not able to reach their schools because of this. And also end the blockade in Gaza and allowing a freedom of movement from Palestinian land to Palestinian land, like the Gaza Strip and the West Bank. And also, and the most important right, which is give the Palestinian people the right of return. So that's one of the things that you can help with. Right now, what we want from you, everybody, is to continue calling your senators, your representatives, write letters, participate in every single action you can, because people are losing their lives. And who's paying for these bombs that kill people? It's our tax dollars. So that makes you responsible at least to do something to stop this. And we need to make the elected officials know that we want ceasefire now. And please say it after me. We want ceasefire now.
Ceasefire now!
So, and yeah, like this is what it is. Like, we want to honor all of the 11,200 plus people who lost their lives, but we want to prevent the other 1,200 people from dying. So, yeah, Allah yarhamhum, may they rest in peace, but we are here to continue the struggle, and we are here to make sure that this ends now. Thank you.
Ceasefire now.
Ceasefire now.
Ceasefire now.
Ceasefire now.
Ceasefire now. All right, we're going to invite up Maxine from Jewish Voices for Peace.
Well, first I want to thank organizers of this vigil. It's really important. And thanks to everybody here who who's here. Thank you, Mohammed. So I was asked to come and speak to you as a Jewish person about why, for me, working for justice for Palestine is so critically important. I was raised in a Jewish household and taught that the most supreme of values is justice for all, and that the dignity and value of life is for all people. At the core of our Jewish tradition, and I actually think all traditions, is the responsibility to save lives. And that's why we're here, and that is the basis of our work. For me, as a Jew, as a pediatric nurse practitioner, which is my profession, as a human being, standing for justice for Palestine is simply consistent with my principles of social justice for all. I was thinking about this afternoon, and I'm struck that we're doing this vigil on a Friday night, which is the beginning of the Jewish Sabbath. So I just want to hold that this is the beginning of the holy day of the week, the most holy day of any time. Brant Rosen, who's a rabbi in Chicago and a member of the Jewish Voice for Peace Rabbinical Council and a newly formed group called Rabbis for Ceasefire, wrote in a post today that on the Sabbath, we're told to suspend our mourning rituals. Suspend our mourning rituals. Hard to imagine. And then he talked about that mourning is very different from grief. The profound grief that we're all feeling now, and that we can never suspend grief. Grief isn't something you turn on and turn off. It's here with us. And so we are here honoring that grief. We're also here to make sure that Israel doesn't do what it's been doing for the last 42 days, which is to weaponize our grief. The Jewish grief is not a cover for the genocide and the brutality of what Israel is doing right now. We won't let that happen. 11,500, 12,000 dead, I don't actually know the number. We don't know the number because there's no way to report. There was an electrical blackout for the third or fourth time today. But we do know that probably about 5,000 of the known dead are children. In fact, the population of Gaza is over 50% youth, children under 18. So as I mentioned, I'm a pediatric nurse practitioner, and I want to talk about for a minute the children and the parents in Gaza. I visited and worked in Gaza on three occasions with health delegations. We were hosted there on those trips by the Gaza Community Mental Health Program. 50%, like I said, of Gaza's population is children. And for the whole of Gaza Strip, there is one child psychiatrist. Why is that? It's largely because of the siege that Israel has imposed for the last 17 years. So psychiatrists can't leave Gaza to get specialized training. So that siege holds people in, and it holds goods and needed services out. I actually have no idea if the clinics of Gaza Community Mental Health Center, needed more than ever now, are even still standing. Prior to the past 42 days, already 4 out of 5 children in Gaza exhibited symptoms of depression, anxiety, and grief. I can't even imagine that number now. It's been said that Gaza is now, quote, the graveyard of childhood. It's also the graveyard of international humanitarian law. Parents write their children's names on their limbs now in case the child can't be recognized after a bombing or the sole survivor of their family. Mental health counselors who work with the children in Gaza face that they have no time themselves to heal or space or time to recover. Think about, as Mohammed mentioned, a child in Gaza, a 12-year-old child in Gaza, have lived through more than 4 major military assaults in their life. And that's not even including the current one. There is no place to ease the memories. So mental health providers try to add positive memories so that children have new, happier ones to add on to the sad ones. We have a good friend in Gaza who works as a counselor at Gaza Community Mental Health Center. And she tells us about the, quote, talk that she's had to have with her children a number of years ago. It's not unlike the talk that Black parents have to have with their children. Rawya, our friend, gathered her children together during one of Israel's past assaults and said to them, if you are the only one to survive in our family, what is your plan? And she said, can you imagine that I, as a parent, have to talk to my children about that? Gaza mental health people talk about the term learned helplessness. As a parent, knowing that you really can't honestly let your children know that you will protect them because you have no way to protect them. So I want to not take much longer, but I want to say something because, as a Jew, I think it's important to talk about anti-Semitism. And when you stand for Palestinian human rights and for justice for Palestine, there's a chance you're going to be called an anti-Semite, or in my case, a self-hating Jew. I've been called it a lot. The conflation of anti-Semitism with the honest critique of the policies and practices of the state of Israel is the playbook, and it is all that they have, that those who support Israel and Israeli policies and practices, that's what they have. There is nothing anti-Semitic about standing up for justice and human rights. That's the only thing that is used by the pro-Israel Zionist lobby to shield Israel from accountability and from adherence to international law. In fact, I want to say, as a Jew, I think it's the most Jewish thing that I can do to be standing here and talking to you and standing for justice for Palestine. So I'll just close by again reminding everyone that this is the opening to the Sabbath. We're taught to imagine on the Shabbat, or on Sabbath, to imagine Olam Haba, the world as it should be, the world as we want it to be, that saving a life is sacrosanct, and that to affirm all humanity is created in the divine image. And again, I'll quote Rabbi Rosen as I close. All of these values are embodied in the two sacred words that we've been chanting over and over and over again these weeks. Cease fire now.
Cease fire now.
To put an end to this vengeful genocidal violence, to negotiate a homecoming for hostages and for Palestinian prisoners, to begin rebuilding and healing through a process of just peace for all.
I know we're cold, I know it's late. Hang here with us, stay with us. We have a few students who are gonna read some stories from We Are Not Numbers, which is a Palestinian organization. It's voices of Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip and who are sharing stories of their own lives or their families' lives. And a few students wanna share those stories with you today.
Thank you again so much for being here. I'm going to read a poem titled Protesting in Heaven by Bosman Darawi. Today, the angels of death protested in heaven, chanting loudly to the Lord, "We're exhausted, we need rest." Some objected to working such long days and nights in Gaza. They asked for a transfer to someplace less severe. After long negotiations, they handed God a list of demands they thought fair. Number one, help. Number two, more days off. Number three, a night shift. Number four, psychotherapy covered by insurance. Number five, a free Palestine. We have confirmed there is no war there, but an unnecessary occupation and a genocide. Thank you.
I'm going to be reading a story written by Noor Diab. The windows are always open to avoid the danger of shattered glass. Every morning I am woken by an obnoxious fly buzzing around the room. It gets louder the closer it is to my ear. Sleep is very precious because I get so little. Therefore, it's annoying to be deprived of it by an insect. I get up and feel irritated. I wonder how I managed to sleep at all through the sound of my grandpa's annoying radio. Every Gazan family has the same battery-powered radio. It's the source of information when there is no electricity or internet. I really hate that radio because of what it represents. It makes me feel so tense because we only use it during times like these when we're under attack and when people we love are dying. I go to the bathroom, I wash my face using a Coca-Cola bottle that I filled with water. Then I go to the kitchen to make coffee with the small amount of water I have left in the bottle. I sit there in the kitchen alone and drink it with feelings of guilt because water's so scarce and some people are going days without drinking anything. Next is the hardest part of my daily routine. I contact my friends one by one to check if they're still alive. I have to prepare myself mentally before I start messaging them. I do this out of habit, although I know it's in vain. I feel very anxious, wondering whether I will ever get a response back. I keep calling my best friend, Maimana, because I heard that there had been a bombardment where she's staying. I try again for the 30th time, but her phone is still not ringing. She has no connection. I feel afraid for her safety, and my heart starts pounding. I repeatedly tell myself that it'll be okay and she'll call me back when she has connection. Eventually, the rest of my family wakes up and I'm no longer alone. We sit together and have our daily conversations about which neighborhoods Israel bombed last night. It's our morning ritual to catch up on what happened during those precious 3 hours of sleep. There are 14 of us staying together in a relative's house. Each of us has a chore to perform in the morning. The men go to the bakery to try and find some bread. Then they take the empty bottles and tanks to the well to fill them with water. Meanwhile, the women start doing the dishes, cleaning the floor, and preparing lunch. Lunch depends on whether there is bread or not. Mostly there is not. Our options are limited, but at least we have options. Some aren't so lucky, and we hear about people suffering from malnutrition. My mom calls and sounds like she has been crying. I ask if she's okay, and she tells me that she is, but I know she's lying to me. My uncle takes the phone and goes to another room. I immediately know something is wrong. My heart feels heavy for the rest of the day. I have a feeling that my family is acting weird and holding something back from me. We receive internet connection just for limited periods throughout the day. Each time we are reconnected, I rush to text my friends, check the news online, and post on social media about what is happening to us. We are bombarded with the same questions. This shows a complete lack of understanding from Western media about what is happening to us. The internet is disconnected again, so like every other normal Palestinian family living through the struggle, we play cards while the stupid radio tells us what's happening via news reports. I have the urge to ask my family if they know something that I should know about, but I hold back because I'm scared that the news will break my heart. Instead, I go to the balcony so I can listen to my favorite song, Hymn to Gentrification by Faraj Suleiman. This song feels like talking to someone who understands my agony. My solitude is interrupted by a phone call from a friend. I pick it up, but it doesn't connect, so I leave it. I kept listening to the song and telling myself that everything is okay. I know that's a lie. I have a dreadful feeling in my stomach. My phone rings again. It's the same friend. I pick up, and this time we are connected. Is it true that my mama and her family have been killed? My heart falls and shatters into a million little pieces. No, no, who said that? I reply, while tears fill my eyes. Everyone said back to me. I scream and the tears start falling from my eyes. She was my very best friend. I love no one like I loved her. At that moment, I feel like I had lost everything. It hurts how you can be talking to someone and they get killed the next day. The memories we shared start playing back in my mind. I can hear her laugh. I remember her singing in the car. It's all too much and I break down. This is the second time in as many weeks that I get the news about losing a loved one. The first time was my dear friend, Abraham. He was unlike anyone else, funny, clever, and with such a big heart. I can't describe the feeling when you get this type of news. It's shattering, like when you drop a plate and it breaks into many pieces. It always gets worse at nighttime. That's when the horror begins. We all sleep together in the same room because it feels safer. I try to sleep through the noises of heavy bombing sounds and news reports on the radio. My eyes get heavier and heavier. And then my mind eventually gives up and I drift off to sleep. The next morning I wake up, but this time there is no annoying buzzing around the room. The fly had been scared away from the bombing overnight, and I get up to face another day of heartache and listening to my grandfather's radio. Ceasefire now.
Ceasefire now.
Ceasefire now.
Ceasefire now.
Hi, I'm going to read a poem by Iman Ashraf Alhi. It's called My Home. Home? What? This place where a wall can bust in, a table fly and spin, glass shatter faster than a flinch. Home? Where? These hours when calm and conversation flash by like commercials in a television series called War? The cast changes in each episode. A sister dies. A cousin disappears. A father is killed. A brother. A cat. A mother, a teacher. Every hero appears just once. The whole series may last a season, a month, a week. Someone else controls our schedule. Home. How? When noises of the drones disturbs our dreams, our beds and couches turn to ash, our wedding plans turn to funerals. Home. Who? My little sister dreams and despairs of traveling, of studying, working, spending quiet hours, not counting seconds until the next bomb bursts our walls.
We have a few students who wanted to share a little bit about their own stories and why they support a ceasefire and are in solidarity with Palestine.
Bismillah, walhamdulillah, wa salatu wa salamu ala khayri khalqillah, Muhammadin ibn Abdullah, وعلى آله وصحبه ومن والاه. Today, I am speaking not as an Arab. I am here speaking as a deeply affected human. I think everybody has seen all the horrible things that are happening in Palestine. From children losing their lives, to families torn apart. In 1 month, almost 5,000 Palestinian children lost their lives. The question echoes in our hearts. What more must we witness? What more must we witness to raise a resounding call for a ceasefire? How much more suffering must we endure before we unite in solidarity? The human cost is immeasurable. And as a global community, we must prioritize human lives above all else. Let's just not witness. Let's all collectively unite in empathy and demand a ceasefire. This is not merely a call for action. It's a plea to end the heartbreaking tragedy that has claimed too many lives. Ceasefire now.
I was asked to say something as a queer leader on this campus, because there's a false rhetoric that is being currently shown in the media right now that the LGBTQ plus community should not be supporting Palestine. If you ignore the fact that this is outright Islamophobic, there is still no reason at all queer people should not be supporting a ceasefire and support for the Palestinian people. You cannot use potential homophobia as an excuse to dehumanize. By turning the conversation away from the genocidal actions that are happening, they are attempting to move the spotlight from the gross negligence of Palestinians and their basic human rights. Do not let them misdirect you. They have not misdirected me, and they should not continue to misdirect others. There are and always will be queer people everywhere, and even if there were none in Gaza, that does not mean you cannot stand against injustice. Being an intersectional ally does not mean you only stand for the things that directly benefit you. Liberation is liberation of its own merit, no matter what, whether that is Palestinian liberation, queer liberation, black liberation, women's liberation, and many others. You cannot ignore the injustice and dehumanization of one to support the other. By supporting a ceasefire, you're supporting the future of millions of people. The current trajectory of Israel's action is definitive, violent, and will destroy futures. However, do not do the disservice of twisting my support and the support of others into a false depiction of anti-Semitism. As was mentioned earlier, this is an issue of oppression, an issue of violence, and the death of innocent lives. It is not an issue of religion, and it is not something that you can move the spotlight away to in order to excuse your actions. People are polarizing an issue that is not even the issue at hand. And as I said earlier, you cannot let them misdirect you. Ceasefire now.
You have been listening to a teach-in held by students at the University of Portland calling for a ceasefire in Gaza.